We studied over the last few weeks the idea of the spirit, spirit soma. That is the idea of a process of development from the non-human or more animal level that takes place a few weeks ago through to the transcendent or superhuman level that takes place at Shavuos time. That means we said that Pesach is a time when things happen automatically. That means if you tune in to the spiritual energy that's available, then you can be carried on a wave automatically to a very high place. But you don't earn it, you don't make it part of you, because you didn't build it yourself. Shavuos is a time when you reach Torah, which is a transcendent level, but the difference is that you reach it there through having built it yourself. How you build it is 49 stages. That's these 49 days, 48 and the 49th, the revision of all of them. That's the process of growing to a situation where the experience of uplift that was given for free in the beginning is earned and becomes part of you at the end. We try to describe in detail, if you remember, the idea that, first of all, the Pesach idea, that it's a transcendent idea, that it's faster than time, beyond the time dimension, that a person gets lifted into that automatically, protected there. And it's dangerous in that phase to start slowing down and examining the thing in detail. And then there's a second phase, which is the detailed examination and building, and it's dangerous there to leap beyond the levels that's made available. So far as Marin says that, and I think I mentioned, it's like a father and son who are walking in a dangerous place and they came across a chest of treasure. So the son wanted to examine it there and then. He wanted to see each jewel and diamond that was in the chest. And the father said to him, it's too dangerous here. Let's take it home. We'll take it to a safe place and there we'll be able to examine it. So the Kabbalistic understanding is that Pesach, the time is too dangerous to start going through the details. You have to take it all as a treasure without being able to see, because if you count it and you start to identify or dissect the bits and pieces, there may not be anything there. Later, the work is to go through it in detail. And at that time, you can't take it all for granted. You have to build each piece and put it together. Let's see now if we can go deeper into the idea of, and maybe also see some practical aspects or applications of the idea of the potency of the beginning of this process, and then the importance and the depth, and what should be the potency of the continuation process. Let's first see if we can identify the idea in its spiritual root, in abstraction, and then let's see if we can bring it down to practical application, which is a very painful subject, as you will see. It's painful, agonizing work of dissection of the self that has to be done in order to be able to use this process. Justified to be serious at this time. Serious is difficult and even dangerous time, and we use this opportunity to be serious as possible about taking apart the details of ourselves as much as possible. The two ideas that we have to understand are, first of all, the phase of beginning, the phase of newness and its importance, and then we have to understand the phase of continuity, what you do with that beginning and how you make the beginning last in the same way. The message is to try to take the moment, the first moment of an experience, of a relationship, of a marriage, the first moment of life, childhood, first moment of formulating, conceiving an idea or a plan, and first of all to make those as potent as possible, nothing left untouched, no level not reached. And then to take what's been achieved and be able to carry that through when the going gets difficult, when there's no inspiration anymore, and when things are just a painstaking, painful plot from one step to the next, to maintain the inspiration of the total experience that happened at the beginning. That's the difficulty, that's the problem. All life fits into this. There's no experience that doesn't fit into one or other of these dimensions, and in fact all life experiences have both. let's understand the idea of a beginning. Let's be patient and try and work out the details before we try and see it in application. If we have the pattern clear, then the applications will be obvious. Difficult, but obvious. So you see that when you look in Torah sources, and actually you can see it from personal sensitive examination of the world, you see that all of an experience is contained in its beginning. And that's its importance. Perhaps the easiest way to illustrate it is the way the mystics do. They talk about conception. The conception is the beginning of an experience, and in the conception is everything. If something's not right then, it certainly won't be right later. If you like, if the raw material is not adequate, then it can't be fixed later. You can make very skillful adjustments, and you can do the best that you can do with the raw material, but if there's a flaw in the raw material, then sooner or later, under adequate stress, that flaw will be a crack, will be a fracture. So before you start any project, the raw material has to be correct. When a child's conceived. So in the moment of conception, what's laid down there definitely will be later. Definitely. You can't regroup or reform the genes once they've been laid down. Later what will happen is that you can make adjustments, and often they have to be cumbersome and major. And even then you'll never be able to get to the perfection that you could have had perfection been achieved in the beginning. The closer you get to the beginning, the more infinitesimal the events are in space and time, and the more potent they are. When you get back to the interface with nothingness, the yesh me'ayin dimension, the moment before an idea comes into your mind, is conceived, the transition zone between nothingness and something, in that moment when you conceive of an idea, that moment is the most potent of all. In fact, easy to see in the development of a child, if one is sensitive to one's own inner process, then you'll see that that's the way thinking goes too. What's the most potent time, the most potent part of a mental experience? Definitely, it's the moment of conception. As you walk around, right, the greatest tension, of course, and the greatest darkness and despair comes just before that moment, and the greatest potency comes at that moment. From that moment on, the ecstasy goes, and what happens is the work begins. And there's no pleasure again until the final completion. And the final completion is a tangible realization of what that idea was in its infinitesimal split second. You walk around, let's say, for hours, or maybe days, or maybe longer, lacking inspiration. So you need a solution to a problem, or you need inspiration, you need an idea. And that's an agonizing process, and the longer it goes, the more hopeless it seems. At its most hopeless moment, in fact, usually so hopeless that you actually give up the attempt, in that moment, you have a spark. That flash of inspiration, that solution to the problem, or that idea of how to go about doing whatever it is you have to do, that idea contains within it everything. It contains all the seeds of everything that will have to grow. It contains the immediate and complete awareness that everything's there. Again, it's hard, it's very clumsy to put into words. But anyone who's experienced it and is aware of what happens knows that this is exactly the way it happens. In that instant, before you've had time, there is no time in that instant. But in that infinitesimal split second, you have all that's needed later, and you're aware that it's all there. You haven't had time yet to examine the details, but you're already aware that all the details are there. And that's the ecstasy of that moment. The ecstasy of that moment is that it stretches from the beginning to the end. You can see in that moment that the whole problem's solved. You aren't even aware of what it is that you become aware of yet, but you know it's all there. In fact, it surprises you when in the next moment the dust begins to settle and the pieces, the bits and pieces start to fall into place. And then you see how beautiful it really is. But that only means that you're becoming aware of the beauty in explicit terms. But in that first millisecond, before the beauty of the bits and pieces and their harmony and how they relate to each other and how they fit together and what they're going to do, before all that becomes apparent, in that first second you know with absolute surety, with a deep spiritual knowledge. In fact, doubt only begins in the next moment. In that moment there's no doubt at all. You know that it's correct, you know it will work, and you know it will be done. The problem is that in the next moment, when things start to take physical shape, of course then the doubts begin. In the next moment you start finding yourself doubting, how could you have had that experience a moment ago? Do these parts really fit together? Yes. Actually, part of the pain of that experience is your own inner inconsistency. It's not really the doubt. It's the fact that you don't trust, you don't know which part of the experience to trust. You're not sure whether the ecstasy that you experienced a moment ago was real, or whether the difficulties that face you now are real. Let's see if we can trace this a bit deeper. What's the source of this? I'll try and take it apart as deeply as we can, because the work of this is to be able to create it. It's not just to understand. During Sri Sahima, what we want to be able to do is put this work into our minds and hearts in such a way that we can become master of this. So if you look in Torah sources, you'll see that beginnings are always described in this way. Beginnings are always described in a way that the beginning is everything, contains everything, is pointed completely towards the end, with absolute faith and loyalty, be no deviation along the way, and the end is contained within the beginning. You pointed out before the word Bereshis, for example. The word Bereshis, in the beginning. The word that states this idea. There's one place in Torah, we have an axiom that when you want to look for an idea's source in Torah, you look for the first time that it's mentioned in Torah. Well, the first time that beginnings are mentioned is the beginning of the Torah. So absolutely everything is contained in that idea, and that's why there's so much Kabbalistic depth and delving into that word itself. But one of the meanings of the word Bereshis, you know, the Kabbalists say that you can take that word and rearrange the letters. Yes, the mathematicians apparently, you check it out, they say that you can rearrange the six letters of Bereshis in 762 different ways. My arithmetic is not that good. Something like that. You can rearrange the letters into different permutations, and each of them spells an idea. Each of those permutations spells out an idea that's intrinsic to the idea of Bereshis. It spells Brit Ash, for example, covenant of fire. Isn't that what a beginning is? Isn't the beginning always go around covenant, around a bris? It's hard to be trying to understand the depth of this idea without bringing it down. Covenant of fire, that flash of fire that's involved in a connection, in a bris. Isn't that what it's all about? And that's the moment of conception. You can rearrange the letters to spell Yirei Shabbos. That means all of the Shabbos dimension. Shabbos is the beginning dimension, the moment when spiritual existence begins. It's also the end of the process, which means that within the word that indicates the beginning of a process is the word of where you're going to. You can rearrange the letters to spell Yashar, Aleph, Beis, Taf. Straight, from Aleph to Beis, the beginning of the process, all the way to the Taf at the end. Exactly what it is. If you look at Bereshis, you see another remarkable thing. Wonderful and amazing idea. We've touched on this occasion, perhaps in the past sometime, is the idea that, see if we can grasp this, work it out together. The mystics say that the beginning of a thing is called a point. When a thing starts, it's a dimensionless point. When a thing has meshech, has dimension to it, then what happens is it becomes a circle. You can understand it. What they mean is, the beginning of a thing is a point. The point is real, it's there, but it has not yet got dimension. That means it's not yet encumbered by any physical expansion, just an idea. Beautiful. But when a thing starts to take on the dimension of continuation, the dimension of maintenance, let's say, that which gives it ongoing existence, that means that which gives it a constancy, an opposite of newness, so then you have what's called a circle. The reason they talk like this is as follows. A perfect circle, what the mystics call the letter Samach, the letter Samach in Hebrew, which is a perfect circle, is the only shape conceivable, the only shape conceivable to the human mind that has nothing new about it. A circle is the only shape that whatever you start will definitely end back in the same place and keep going around. There's no other shape like that. If you take the smallest arc of a circle, the most infinitesimally small arc of a circle, the givens of that arc, if continued, will definitely describe a circle. That means, from the givens that you see now, if you project them consistently, you know in the first instant of it that you have a circle, and you know where it will end, and you know that it won't end. There's no point of newness. There's no point on it different than any other point. There's no other shape like that. A straight line, for example. You don't know where it will end. An irregular shape. You have no idea where. There's no way of predicting from part of the line where the next bend will come. The next corner. Are we together? But a circle, you don't need any of it except the most minimal amount. Of course, if it's a point, then it's not a circle. If it's a point, then it is transcendent. But as soon as a circle, any segment of a circle has dimension, then the circle is already complete. You don't even need the whole thing. It's finished already. It's complete already. And that's why it says that the letter of a circle, the letter of Samach, is the letter of deep evil, because it's the letter that can bind a person into a path that he cannot get out of. that even from the beginning of the path he'd be locked in and can't generate any newness. And of course it's a letter of tremendous transcendent potential. Those two opposites, both in the same. Put most eloquently, the way they express it is that it's the letter that describes woman. Because woman is a creature, woman is a being who has the ability for maintenance. A man can't do that. Man can only generate the spark that will be a human being. But a woman can pick up the spark and maintain it and continue it and build it and build it until it's real. So she has the faculty, not just of beginnings. She has the faculty of maintenance and addition and building. And that's the danger of being a woman. The greatness of woman, of the female pole of reality and of being a woman in human terms, the greatness of it is that she can build something until it's real. Man can't do that. He can just begin the process. He has that experience which is the beginning of all process. That's called ma. But he can't build a thing and bring it to fruition. The woman is the one who can pick up a beginning and bring it to something that's real. That's the greatness and beauty of being a woman. She can build something. That's why a woman is called bina, to build. That which is built, she's able to build, which means construct. Add one thing to another. The danger of being a woman is that when you're engaged in maintenance functions, you can be engaged in such a maintenance role that there's no newness at all. And you can be concretizing so thoroughly that you're free solid. Kabbalistic commentaries point out that the first summer, remarkable thing. You look at Bereshit, you'll see. You look at Genesis, remarkable thing. You look at the book of Genesis, you look at Bereshit, the description of the creation of the world has no samach at all. You know that? For a great distance, if you read Bereshit, for a great distance, there's no samach at all. The entire description of the creation, the formation of the world, is achieved with no samach at all. There's no letter samach. In the entire, the first time samach arrives in the book of Bereshit is Vayizkor Basar Tachtena, and Hashem calls the flesh over her, over the rib, the flesh of woman. When woman's created in the world, yes, the first being, the first creature who can take a spark of newness and now give it ongoing existence, that loyalty that is what a woman is, that can build, so then you have a samach. There are two samachs that occur before it that are slightly different than Kabbalists explain it, but that's, even those fit into the pattern, but that's not the point. Remarkable thing. So the Torah is saying that in the beginning, when you have a beginning, you cannot afford in that moment to have the dimension of habit or process or crystallization or concretization. You cannot afford to have that. Because if you put in the dimension, if you put in at the beginning the dimension that's not newness, so then it's not complete newness. The dimension that's the beginning of a thing must be an explosion of newness that has nothing limiting at all about it. Not even enough limiting to be able to make it concrete and real. That's its danger. And you have here the danger and the beauty of being male. The beauty of being a male is that incredible unbounded energy of creation. And the danger of being a male is that without a female to build it, it's nothing at all. It disappears immediately. Dissipates instantly. That's right. Beauty is in the dimension of woman, because it's where two opposites can harmonize. It's not just the beginning, it's the beginning and the completion. That's why woman is called a kala, which means complete and built, constructed, entire. That's why there was a Hasidic Rebbe in Jerusalem who used to give his students apples. The unmarried ones used to give half an apple. There's another parsha in the Torah. There's another two other parshas that I know of in the Torah. The whole parsha is spelled without a summer. One is the Parsha Bechor, that which describes the whole process of the sanctity and elevation of the firstborn. Same thing, when you have a firstborn, a newness, something born new into the world, the Torah describes the whole thing without a samach at all. Remarkable thing that. This person would try to write a few pages of prose in English, without an S, without it. Remarkable thing. And there's one other Parsha, the Baal Turim, I think, points out that it is a Parsha of Menorah, the light. The light of the Menorah, the light in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Mishkan, it shines out to light the world, which represents the light of Torah. That light itself is a primary, seminal light, and there's no samach in the description of that entirety. Now what do we see? We see that the Jewish conception of potency, the Torah conception of what it is to be able to live in the finite dimension, the dimension that does have length and breadth to it, it does have crystallized and concretized elements. The secret of being able to do it is that all the concretization and crystallization should only be a keeping alive of the original spark. If the crystallization or concretization comes to freeze and limit and shrink, So that's the death process. But if the crystallizing process comes just to give enough reality to the original spark, to keep it a spark, so that's called life. And that's why the Kabbalists say that that's what a woman does with the seed of a child. She doesn't freeze it in the form that she's given it. She just gives it enough reality to keep it alive as a spark. And it keeps growing because it's still alive. And it grows and grows and grows. And even when it involves pain, and it does involve pain, it involves loyalty, it involves dedication, there's no time out. And at the end it involves pain and separation. And when a child's older, a mother has to separate again. But she's always there giving just enough concrete element that the thing should be able to continue. But if she gives too much of that, she squashes out the flame. An incredible delicacy that's required to be able to do that. And of course they point out, if you look at Jewish works on marriage, you'll see the same thing. That a woman concretizes and crystallizes the marriage. If she doesn't do enough of it, so then you have disloyalty. And if she does too much of it, well, then you have freezing of the relationship. And the love's not there. And the spark isn't there anymore. She has to be absorbing the spark and the energy in a marriage to the extent that it's kept alive as a spark, but making it real all the time so the relationship is built into something meaningful. A full expression to every energy. Let's see if we can feel this out and explore it. That's the idea. That's the idea. That's the idea of news. The second phase is not news. The second phase is the responsibility and the work that goes with taking that newness and building on it, but building on it in such a way that it remains new. It's easy to take the newness and just fix it into a habit-forming drug and then just become fixate and just become a circle rolling on and on and on with no newness to it. That's not being alive. There are sources that say that if a person's alive today because he was alive yesterday, that's not called being alive. That's called rolling on towards dying. To be alive today, you have to be alive today because you're alive today, because you got born today, because you recreated who you are today. In fact, the Kabbalists understand every second of human existence in that plane. I'll share with you an example. It says, who is the man who showed us this? In the world, we see it in Bereshit. Where was the human dimension of this? We see it in a man called Abraham. Abraham. He was the beginning of the world. It says, Ele Tobe Sashamayim Ba'aretz, Behibarov. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth in their being created. Behibarov. He rearranged the letters of Behibarov and spells the Abraham. That's what it says in Kabbalistic writings. That these are the generations of the heavens and the earth manifest in Abraham. That's the man who is the beginning of heaven and earth, because he's a man who makes new beginnings. He is a Bereshis of the world. How was he a new beginning? Obviously in his life, the events that happened in his life, obviously, I'm not going to go into that now, examine that, you'll see. But in depth, he was the man who said to Hashem, Anochi Afar Va'efer. Amazing thing. I'm dust and ashes. I am dust and ashes. And we know there's nothing poetic in Torah, nothing empty poetic. It has to have inner depth. So they explain this. I'm dust and ashes means this. Unbelievable idea. Understanding this idea correctly, a person will never be the same again. If a person once understands this idea at all, you could never be the same again. Anochi Afar Va'efer means this. Afar means dirt. It means the rich earth from which things grow. And Afar means ashes. So they explain this. To say that you are dirt, dust, and ashes means this. Not dust, dust. It means dust, rich earth, that kind of dust. Dust and ashes means this. Ashes means that what I was until now, I've just burnt. Ash is the elemental remains of something. Yes, if you want to take something and see what it consists of in the lab, you take it and you ash it at a very high temperature instantaneously. What you're left with is ash. Ash is just the elemental constituents of the thing with no construction. That means the basic elements are there, but no construction. Yes. So this is how Abraham describes himself. Anochi Afar. I'm a man. This is what he says to Hashem. That means, what does it mean he says to Hashem? It means when he faces reality. This is his assessment of himself. You follow? When he speaks to the source of existence, he grasps himself in this way. Anochi Afar, that means Hashem, what I was until now, no matter what it was, no matter how incredible, no matter how supernatural, whatever, what I was till now, I've just this minute ashed. Okay, all that's left of what I was till now, just the elements. And instantaneously I transform that into the earth from which my next existence grows. You hear that? That means he's going through a consistent transition. That means minute to minute, second to second, he's recreating, ashing everything that he was, leaving only enough of the elements to have continuity, and reconstructing them in such a way, and even then they're not an entire existence, they're just the earth from which something new grows. And as soon as that new thing grows, the ashes of that one grows again, in an exponential fashion. They say, you know, Lashon Kodesh, Hebrew, has this idea so clearly, running through it so clearly, there's no way to miss it. You know, the root in Hebrew for this idea, unbelievable idea, the root for this is, in Hebrew you have a very interesting root, Aleph, Yud, and Nun. Those three letters spell a number of interesting words in Hebrew. First of all, they spell Ayin. Ayin means nothingness, there is not. We say Yesh Me'ayin, something from nothing. Ayin means something that is not. Yesh Me'ayin, something from nothingness. If you rearrange the letters, it spells Ani, which means I, my identity, sense of self. And if you use the same root, you have a word called Anna. Anna is a Hebrew word that's untranslatable. Anna means it's an untranslatable expression of longing or she'ifa, pleading, drive towards a higher state. Like it says, Anna Hashem or Shiana. Please, I mean, please is a pathetic translation, but it means an expression of longing to be saved or to reach a situation of redemption. Can't even translate that it's such a potent word. They're all variations of the same root. You know what's remarkable about it is this. That means you have a word in Hebrew that means nothingness, complete nothingness. You have a word that means the self as it is now, and you have a word that expresses longing, that means a movement towards a new situation that is so amazing that it can't even be expressed. That means it's just the pure desire for it in a word that can't even be translated. Where do you see this? As follows. How do you speak in Hebrew? When you say to somebody, where do you come from? They say, may I invite. Where do you come from? Translated loosely in English, it means, may I invite. Where do you come from? And who are you now? Your sense of self, that's Ani. And where are you going? You say, Anna Telech. Where are you going? Le'an. The same root. Anna Telech. Where are you going? So understand that. That means this. You say to somebody, yes? Mundane. The person walked in from there and he's moving to there. Yes? Moved in from this part of the house and he's standing in front of you for a minute and moving out there. And you say to him, may I in Bata? Where did you come from? Le'an. Anna Panecha. Anna Telech. Where are you going? Well, you know what that means literally? You see, we speak, those who don't understand Hebrew, so they're missing Mechus HaEver. This one's missing a limb. And those who speak Hebrew hear it even less. Because those who speak Hebrew hear it in its conventional form so powerfully that they can't hear it in its essence. When you say to somebody in Hebrew, may I in Bata, where did you come from? You are saying to the person, literally, you come from nothingness. May I in means you come from nothingness. You hear that? That's the way to speak to somebody. Somebody walks in and you say to the person, where did you come from? In English you say, where did you come from? It means, where did you come from? In Hebrew, when you say to the person, where did you come from? It means, you come from nothingness. You have just arrived out of nothingness. That's what you say. I mean, we live with it. That's why they say that Israelis, people who brought up speaking Hebrew, tremendous problem hearing this. And then when he moves out, you say to him, Anna Teilech. That means, you are now moving into a dimension that is so inexpressibly great that I can't even find a word for it. You hear that? You know why? Because the Jewish consciousness is built, Lashon Kodesh, is the vehicle, Hebrew, is the vehicle of Jewish consciousness, and that's the way a Jew thinks. When a person walks in, you apprehend his existence now as a transition from nothingness to who he is now. No less than that. Nothing less than that satisfies. You hear that? That means the previous second of this mundane person's mundane existence is a nothingness compared to who he is now. And that's nothing compared to what he'll be in 3 seconds' time. Yes? The transition from nothing to something now pales into insignificance compared to my grasp of what he'll be 3 minutes from now compared to what he is now. And that's what's contained in the words. That means that when a Jew speaks in mundane, everyday language, he means he's expressing the idea of a transition from a nothing to human terms, and from human terms to superhuman transcendent in an exponentially greater fashion. Well, I must say, he should do it once a day. He was doing it constantly, I remember. We couldn't handle doing it constantly. We wouldn't get anything done. But do it once a day, once a year maybe. Spirit of Omer. Once a month, once a week, once a day maybe. At least. Think about it. Think about it once in a lifetime. That's the idea. Let's try and see some of its practical applications. If you examine human existence, you'll see that the closer you are to the beginning, you'll see that you can actually feel this focus. You can see it, you can feel it. You take the beginning of life as childhood. The moments of childhood, and the closer to the beginning, the more potently, are the formation of who the child is. But any educator will tell you that. I remember once being present in the presence of a Hasidic Rebbe. person I have tremendous respect for, very amazing individual from whom I was married. I married to learn certain things. And I was present when a young couple brought in their child. This was their firstborn child, was a young girl. The baby was, I think, I can't remember, but a few months old. 3 months old, 4, 5, 6, I can't remember, I think 3 months old. The couple approached the Rebbe, and they said to him that this is their first child, they're very idealistic about the world. Could he please give a bracha to this child? Should give a bracha that this child should turn out to be very special. The child should turn out to be with unbelievable powers. This little girl should grow up with tremendous sanctity, tremendous depth, unbelievable. He smiled beautifully. I'll never forget this. He said, it's much too late. And he gave a bracha, the child should be wholesome and normal. Understand? The influence on a child, no matter how young, what a child absorbs then, that's the genes of his consciousness. What will happen later is a lot of heavy surgery to try to change things that almost certainly can't be changed. But what can be done then? You will never, the effects of what can be done then, what can be built in the child's consciousness then, the sanctity, the kedusha, the aspiration, the nobility, the refinement, the dignity that can be put into a child of any age, can never be undone. I heard from Diane Duna the following story. Unbelievable story. There was a community between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. This was in the, it must have been the early 1950s or just before, in the days of the last few years of the life of the Chazon Ish, great leader of the generation in Israel, lived in B'nai Brak. There was a community. The community was starting a school for children, starting a cheder, a kindergarten, a gun for babies. Little children, first level, 3 years old, 4 years old, 2 years old, 3, 4, 5. The problem was the community consisted of religious people and non-religious people. And there was a battle among the parents and the educators how they'd run the school. The religious people wanted it run on religious lines, children should be brought up that way, and the secular people wanted the school on secular lines. But they needed each other, couldn't have separate schools. It was a tremendous expense and difficulty and impractical to have separate schools. So they decided not to go that way. They'd get on with each other. So what happened? The meeting of the parents, you can imagine what kind of an event it was. The meeting of the parents and educators, they finally thrashed out an agreement. They finally came to an agreement. The agreement was, listen to this, that to ensure each other's privileges and rights, what they would do was, they would choose a principal of the school who was religious, and all the teachers would be secular. Or, a principal who was secular, and all the teachers religious, there would be a checks and balances. But, and everyone agreed. But they couldn't agree which way around. They couldn't agree whether the principal should be frum, and the teachers who actually direct contact with the children should be secular, or should he be secular, yes, to set the tone, and the people have direct contact with the children. So they all decided to ask the Chazon Ish, even the secular. He was known to be a transcendent human being, famous even among the most irreligious of Israeli society. And they decided they would send a representative, one of the frum members, they would trust him, one of the religious men. They sent him off to ask the Chazon Ish, which of these options should they go for? You hear that? This is what happened. Went to Chazon Ish, and he presented the situation to Chazon Ish. We've decided we're going to run this community. We have two elements in the community. It's very important to us as religious people that we have our input. And therefore, how should we run the community? Should we have the principal, yes, the director, whatever you call it, should be one and the teacher the other, or vice versa? The Chazon Ish said the following thing. Unbelievable thing. He said the following thing. He said, tell them, go back, tell the secular that they can appoint the principal and the teachers. All you want is to put up the pictures on the walls. That's all. He took some money out of his pocket and he said, take this bill and go to a certain Jew in B'nai Brak who sells books and pictures and ask him for certain pictures of Gedolim. Pictures! Pictures of the Bris Karov, pictures of the Chofetz Chaim, pictures of these giants, right? Photographs and pictures of these giants of spiritual sensitivity and greatness. So the man did as he was told. He went with it, took the Chazon Ish's money. He went to this bookseller, the man who sold his photographs in B'nai Brak. He told him that the Chazon Ish gave me this money. When the man heard that that money, that bill was handed over by the Chazon Ish, he pulled a sack of pictures of the Gedolim. The man took it back to the meeting, to the people of the school, and he said that the Chazon Ish has said, this is what he announced, the Chazon Ish has said that we have no problem. You, secular people, can appoint the principal and you can appoint the teachers, we just want the pictures on the walls. You know what the response was? When the secular teachers heard that, they started a separate school. You hear that? They started a separate school. You hear that? These people, without any Torah education, knew the effect that there would be on these children just by the pictures on the walls. You hear that? They were sensitive to that degree. And then what happened was the community started two schools. You can look it up for yourself. Little child, 4-year-old, 5-year-old, you see these pictures, shining faces of Kedusha. Look at these pictures yourself, no matter how jaded you are, no matter how desensitized you are by the world, no matter, even if the last picture of a human you saw was the kind they mechanics put up in the workshops, you'll still appreciate faces that have the world of the responsibility, the world of responsibility for the whole Jewish world on their shoulders. Absolutely not a glint of self-interest. I mean, it comes through clearly. The children would see this picture, they'd ask questions. Who are these people? Teachers would have to answer, the parents would have to answer. It would be enough to be a threat to the secular ideology, and they felt they couldn't cope with it. That was the response. The beginning of a relationship, beginning of a marriage. That's given as a gift. We've discussed this idea before. It's given as a gift as an inspiration, as focus. The trick is, a person has to be sensitive to that focus so that he can carry that through into the second phase. Person has to use the power of the first moment. Person has to use the first moment and build the first moment such as focus as possible. It's not rely on being able to. Person has to choose the moment. It says, Chaim Shmulevitz brings out, that when the Jews went out of Egypt, when we went out of Mitzrayim, we're talking here between Pesach and Shavuos, a few weeks ago. Yes, when we went out of Mitzrayim, so as they left Egypt, they were given the commandment of freeing slaves. The Torah talks about the mitzvah of freeing slaves, Shichrur Avodim. The Jews were given that not at Sinai, they were given that mitzvah as they went out of Egypt. So before Shem asked the question, why couldn't it wait till the rest of the Torah was given? You hear this? The Torah was given at Sinai. It was good enough to stand at Sinai in that awesome presence and receive all the mitzvahs. Surely the impact, you want to have an impact on somebody, you want them to remember a mitzvah, that they'll give their life for it. So surely that's the time when they experience the fire and the lightning and their awesome transcendence, their bodies, their souls left their bodies. That's the moment. You have to preempt all the rest of the mitzvahs that as they go out of Egypt, you give the mitzvah of freeing slaves. But the answer is beautiful answer. The answer is, that was the moment they were being freed, right? That the potency of that moment is unequaled. The moment that they were being freed, the transition from being slaves to not being slaves, that consciousness, the potency and consciousness of that moment, that's the only moment. You give a person in that moment the obligation, you follow, that devolves, that relies, that uses, that needs that sensitivity, that's the moment. Be too late later. No matter how great the moment would be in objective terms, they'll never have the potency of when the person experienced that himself. So Hashem preempted, yes, and he drew that mitzvah out of the rest of the Torah, and he gave it at the moment. The person has to do that when you're educating children. Child gets educated. You have to choose the first moment in its most potent and sensitive form, and you have to make it as powerful as possible, as sweet as possible, as powerful as possible. When a child starts learning Torah, the custom in Cheder, they still do it today in Israel. The custom when a child goes to Cheder for the first time, his father carries him, he wraps him in a talus. The boy of 3 goes to learn Aleph Beis, 4, 5, whatever it is. Child goes to learn Aleph Beis for the first time. His father wraps him in a talus at home so he can't see anything, and he carries him to the Cheder. He sees nothing impure on the way, and he unwraps the talus and he puts the child down in front of an Aleph Beis, and on the Aleph Beis they have honey. And the child licks the honey off the letters of Aleph Beis. That's what he does. His first contact with Aleph Beis is on the level of the child, and speaks to him on the level of the adult. Wouldn't mean anything to him. You use the moment, the sweetness of the moment that he can relate to, and that's what you give him. And you give him sweets, and make it a special occasion. That will be indelibly imprinted on the child's mind. No matter how old he is, when he's learning Zohar once, yes, when he's a great Talmid Chacham, the sweetness of it will go back in his blood to the moment when it tasted of honey. What do we do with our first moment? What exactly do we do with our first moment? How do we utilize it? Do we do these things? Do we try and build them up to that experience? Do we try and take those first experiences, then do we make security for ourselves to continue them throughout life? You have to go hand in hand. You have to choose the moment. The moment has to be done with the maximum potency calculated. And when the potency is there, you have to extract a sign. You have to extract a thread that will always remain with you from that experience. And you have to keep that thread with you. so that later when the boredom sets in and when the expectancy is gone, you have that thing to remind you. They say there was a man called Palti Ben Laish. Amazing story, difficult to go into the details. He was given to marry a certain woman, daughter of Saul, Shaul HaMelech. And she was already engaged to David, to David. And Shaul felt that the engagement was annulled. And Palti Ben Laish knew it was not annulled. But he had to live with the woman until the time would be right that she'd be able to marry David. So he couldn't have a relationship with her. So what did he do? He had to live with her. He had to live in intimate proximity with her. And only his determination that this wasn't right would prevent him from transgressing, from doing what he knew wasn't right. So what did he do? So it says he drove a sword between them. He drove a sword between the beds. And he said, anyone who crosses this sword deserves death. So he said. So Mephoshim asked, sword driven in the ground, it's going to stop somebody? Let's understand the situation. Two people will be alone. Okay? There'd be a sword driven into the ground. It's very dramatic, you know, no doubt. Are they going to stop somebody in the heat of a problem? What's the meaning of this? How does it? What does it say that he did this one? Why does it say that that sword saved him? So Chaim answers, the sword didn't save him. The sword was a reminder of the potency of his decision when he made the decision. You follow? So that when he would be blinded and conveniently forget the way the Yetzer Hara makes you, forget the potency of the first moment, and have been crossing over the line of the forbidden, he'd see a reminder. The sword wouldn't stop him, wouldn't stop anyone. But it would be a potent reminder of a resolve. It would take him back to the potency of that moment. So you see what a wise man does? A wise person, he takes, extracts out of the moment. He has the presence of mind in a moment of power. He has the presence of mind to extract from it something that will be potent even later. And he lays down that element. So when difficulty will come later, and when he may be low and depressed and ill and who knows what else, there'll be something that's beyond what he is that will call him to account. The Kabbalists say that the rainbow does that, and there are other examples. Do we do that? Is that what we do? Do we choose our beginnings carefully? I'll share with you some painful ideas, experiences. What can I tell you? I spend some of my time speaking to people. For one reason or another, discussing people's problems. Because you can say over a few nice ideas you heard from your Rebbe, people think you can solve their personal problems. It's not true. But that's what I do. And people come to me sometimes to sort out problems where I'm not able to say it to them, but the only thing a person could do in such a situation is cry and say to the person that you shouldn't have been there in the first place. The problem's not now. The problem's what got you into this. You took a moment, you got into something, you started a moment of beginning. I can't say that to the person and make it feel much worse. The problem's already almost insurmountable. To explain to them that it's too late now. And I'm not saying this to make people miserable who are in such a, but the thing is to remember to make a new beginning, that the next beginning shouldn't be that way. The transcendent idea is that every moment's a new beginning. No matter how bad it is, if you lift it to the level of a beginning, if you shrink that circle to an infinite point, so it can come out something different the next time. It can be done any time. It's difficult, but it can be done. People in situations where what they're doing is trying to manipulate the impossible. What happens is the situation's trained. The whole situation's trained. Unacceptable. And now the person's trying to manipulate the details of an impossible situation. No matter how you put the pieces together, it's not going to make a success. So what do we do? What's our response? What's a human response? You find yourself in a situation like that. You go back to, have you got the guts? You got the courage to go back to the beginning? We haven't got the courage. What you do normally is every piece that slots in and shows you that you are wrong, you work into the problem. You make that part of the problem. You work it in. You use that as a proof that you're right. Midrashim say, Paro, Pharaoh. Pharaoh, can you imagine a crazed human being like that? He's leader of a country, the greatest empire on earth. And Hashem gives him warning, fair warning, time after time. He shows him his power and what will be with him. There couldn't be fairer warning than that. What does he do? Each time he repents, and then as soon as the pressure's off, he does it again. Not the Mephoshim say, unbelievable thing. And where does he get himself to? Can you imagine? Can you put yourself, understand this? Let's first laugh at him before we laugh at us. What happened? What did he do? Yes, he was shown Hashem's power and he admitted and he thought it was true. And after the first five times, he has no more power to change anymore. That's what happens. Once you close the circle, and once the speed of that circle speeds up, and once the rut is drilled, and once the groove is formed, you can't get out of it. So the first five times, and then Hashem hardens his heart. He can't, and what does it lead him to? Eventually, he enters a situation. I mean, imagine. There the sea has split. The Jews are passing through on dry land miraculously. And he follows them to his obvious, imminent destruction. And what kind of human being does that? The answer is you. You and me. That's the answer. How does he do it? And the first thing to say, because every step of the way, unbelievable things, it's ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous, until you see how you do it. That every step of the way, he found justification for his own opinion. What happened? It was a plague. So his advisor said to him, but don't you see? Look. So they endured the plague. And at the end of the Makkah, which was almost unsurvivable, death and destruction on all sides, after the dust settled, after one plague, and they could breathe again for a few seconds, his advisors came and said, listen, now's your chance, send them out, send the Jewish people out. Can't you see you're wrong? At that moment, Paro turned to them and he said, no, I'm right. And they said incredulously to him, you're right now? Why? What? He said, it stopped, didn't it? You hear that? Stopped. Isn't that a proof? Yeah, a person will extract almost impossible, crazed vestige of nonsense out of a situation, and he'll say, the smoker wakes up in the morning, coughs blood onto the floor. I have to start smoking filters. Half the reason we have this problem is because the world's that way. The world out there. What's happening out there? The world is being swept right now. I mean, you can see it at every turn. You don't need to read the medical journals for this. Yes, you read the popular press. The world's being swept by a lethal epidemic. A lethal epidemic that hasn't yet peaked. It's terrifying. Lethal. Agonizing. How are we going to deal with it? If you can manipulate the course to do it a little differently. Is that the response? There's only one response to that situation. It's obvious. But we can't go back to the beginning and reassess our values. We don't do that. I mean, that's who we are. Isn't that what society is doing? You speak to the people responsible for these decisions, they'll tell you, I've done so. Speak to the people responsible for the decisions that are being made medically, public policy in this area, you'll see that the way it's being handled is completely irresponsible. It's nonsensical. It's crazed. It's ineffectual. It's crazed. Never mind the moral problem. I'm talking about the moral problem. I understand the moral problem. There's no discussion that the situation shouldn't have got to this. But ignoring the moral problem, just common sense, even if you take an animal view of existence, the way to solve the problem is to revamp the values, to go back to a situation where the problem would stop instantaneously. The problem would stop instantaneously. Virtually instantaneously. If the values were what they should be, yes, the transmission of this thing would be stopped instantaneously. There'd be a few more million deaths of those already lethally affected, and the problem would be finished. But we can't entertain the suggestion. The people I've spoken to involved in policy making, they tell you that, well, because no one would accept it, nobody would accept such a policy. Huh? It's unrealistic. If we advise such a thing, they wouldn't come to us for help. They wouldn't listen to us at all. They'd continue doing even worse. So therefore, what we've got to do is we've got to manipulate the wrong. We must take, as a given, the wrong, you follow the trait, and let's see how we can manipulate the trait. When Rabbi Tversky was here, told of a girl, a Hasidic story of a girl who was sick, and the doctors gathered round, old time Europe, the doctors all gathered round and they declared that there was no hope. The only hope was one particular thing. There was only one thing. She had to eat certain food that Jews don't eat. Certain animal, certain pink snub-nosed animal Jews don't eat. She couldn't do that, she'd rather die. So they called the Rovin, and the rabbi told us, Pikuach Nefesh, if that's the only way, it's a mitzvah, you have to do it. No, she can't eat it. She'd rather die. Finally, pressure of the mitzvah, if save your life, she has to do it. So they convince her. So they're about to go and fetch her, and she says, but it's got to be shechted. Kosher. Got to be shechted. After they shechted it, she's got to be salted. Salted properly, kosher. And she wanted the lungs checked. So Some situations are trapped. Situations trapped. The question shouldn't have been asked. People come to sort out difficulties in a situation where the pathetic part of the situation... How many people haven't I spoken to? You don't need me to tell you. Examine it yourself. People are trying to dismantle or disentangle the elements of a problem marriage. But simple common sense, simple Jewish values, basic Torah values, never mind transcendent, just basic human common sense Torah values. The person would never have gone to that relationship. One lady came to see me a few months ago in a terrible, entangled relationship. It was completely unhealthy, disastrous relationship. So I said to her in a conversation, why did you marry him? She said, because my parents said I shouldn't. That's the motivation. She was going through a rebellious phase and a rebellion against the parents. The motivation for choosing this person. Another lady told me, because he was boyish. He was a certain boyishness about him. This is 10 years later, and there's still a boyishness about him. Another lady told me she married him because he needed somebody to look after. He needed somebody to fix him up and look after him. She wanted to undertake that project. So she hasn't managed. What happened to good old-fashioned common sense? If people had been living, I can't help saying that if parents want their children to turn out halfway normal these days, they have to put them into a very, very orthodox religious framework, even if they've got no conception of this religion. But there's no hope otherwise for turning out normal. You have to become extremely religious just to have normality. Where else is there a system where children at least consider what's important in a marriage, you know? First, at least consider the other person's normal, healthy, psychologically intact, basically. Children choose these days a career, let's say. People buy a motor vehicle with a lot more agonizing and introspection than they choose a marriage partner. It's not an exaggeration. The marriage partner is chosen because the relationship began. How did it begin? Let's trace it exactly. The person's unsuitable, okay? The marriage is therefore a disaster. Why did they marry the person? Because there was a relationship already. They fell in love with each other. They were totally enmeshed in each other. It shouldn't have been. They shouldn't have been that deeply involved with each other. But if you ignore that, where did they meet exactly? In a place they shouldn't have been in the first place. They shouldn't have been there. They shouldn't have been in that place in the first place. It was a trite place to be. It was a completely unkosher way of meeting. They shouldn't have met. And had they met, it should have been in a way where the values of the conception of the meeting should have been correct and spiritual and human. And not purely physical or purely accidental. So if you trace back a marriage, and generations, you trace back fractured children being brought up in a home that's shattered. Where does that begin? It begins with two people who had a relationship that began where they shouldn't have been at all in the first place and met by accident. And the first moment was an insignificant moment, but they got married because of that. But that's not the way you get married. But this is so obvious. The way you get married is very consciously. In the right place at the right time with a lot of careful assessment, much more than buying a motor vehicle. Choosing a garment. Yeah, that doesn't happen to you accidentally. Where does that problem begin? Because the parents didn't educate the children that way. So the children were brought up in a value system like that. So the children didn't have an option. The children should have been sent into a system where what was drummed into them from the beginning was common sense, basic self-serving survival. But we don't even think about the value system. Person chooses a career. How many people haven't I seen? Person defines himself as his career. That's a significant problem. In Israel, you don't have that. Nobody is living anywhere. But in some parts of the West, people define themselves as their profession. But that's not who you are, and that's not important. Your profession is some aspect of self-fulfillment if you're lucky, and it's a way of earning a living. But people don't see themselves that way. They see themselves as their profession. So what happens is the person becomes an eminent urologist or cardiac surgeon or who knows what it is, and he's not a human being. He's not a human, he's not a father, he's not a husband. So society looks at him as successful because society judges the external, but there's nothing inside. There's a great hollow, empty rattle. That's not the way to think. The way a child should be taught to think is that the beginnings of his formation of his conception of what he is should be what he is as a human being. That's what a parent should be doing, sitting and talking to a child. Not when you grow up will you be. The child thinks when he grows up he'll be a this or he'll be a that. The first thing is, will you be human? Will you be human and Jewish? The parents should show that they're not concerned whether the person's a cardiac surgeon or a... Doesn't matter what he is. as a profession is completely irrelevant. People send their children to schools. What do the schools teach? The schools mention being human, let alone Jewish. The schools teach a child that he can spell in Afrikaans. Yes, they give him high marks for that and prizes. And they drum it into him when he's too young to know the difference. And they give him prizes, and they make a child feel heartbroken because the child next to him got a prize for being able to add or spell. This child might not have that talent, and this child might be a wonderful, beautiful child who gives of his own to somebody else who needs it. No one mentions that. On the contrary, they'll trample on that. The child's a bit more sensitive than anybody else, they'll trample on him. He'll be made to feel certain that he's a nobody. And the prizes all the way through for spelling in Afrikaans. But that won't help you in marriage. When you get into the thick of the difficulties of a marriage, or a relationship with your children, or your parents, or whatever else it is, being able to spell and do higher calculus, really irrelevant. The prizes are irrelevant, and the talents are irrelevant. You spent the best years, the most impressionable phase, doing what's completely irrelevant. The child isn't sent to a yeshiva environment, where the people are special, not just yeshiva, it's not good enough, the uniform and the name are irrelevant. It's got to be a place where that's the motivation. Where that's what's rewarded. Where that's what's admired. If you can't find such a school system, or you don't have the courage to revamp the values and go back to that stage, then you have to put it in where you can. When the conversation around the table, you go out visiting someplace and you have a 6-year-old daughter, and there's a young man over there that the parents are talking of what academic prowess this young man has, and everybody's admiring. That's the time the mother should lean over to a little girl and she'd say, look how he helps take off the table. That's what she should say. That's what's important. The little girl should grow up admiring in a man the fact that he helps. That he's gentle, that he's sensitive, that he's kindly. That's what she should have in her mind. That's what she should remember from her mother. The fact that he did calculus or he could speak in Latin is not going to make her life human. That's the syndrome of you shouldn't have been there in the first place. So what's needed, what we have to be sensitive to, what we have to be aware of, is that you have to be sensitive to the potency of the first phase of anything, the first moment of the first phase, the beginning, whether it's a Pesach in the year, whether it's a Rosh Hashanah, whether it's your childhood or your children's childhood, whether it's the beginning of a marriage. You should extract the beauty of it and make a reminder. You had a wonderful time before you were married. The relationship was beautiful. The first week of marriage was beautiful, was idyllic. So that's what you focus on. That's what you remember. You make some sign. It might seem petty to the outside world. It's irrelevant. You take a sign, something tangible, and you put it where you always see it. And that must accuse you. That sign must accuse you. Because nobody feels that way a year later, or 2 years later, or 10 years. Nobody feels like that. Nobody even remembers what it was like. It seems like a dream. You distrust the emotion even. So there you have on your mirror, or wherever it is that you'll definitely see it, you have an accusation staring you in the face. It reminds you what it was like. And that now you're in the phase where you have to make it like that. That's what you have to do. You have to build the potency of the moment so it will never leave you, and then you have to immortalize the moment. You have to immortalize the moment so that it becomes a bereshis that continues yashar from aleph to base all the way through time. The only way out of a trap situation is to know that there are two things you have to know. You learn from the mistake, that you wouldn't do it again next time, but you can salvage this operation as well. It shouldn't have been a salvage operation. It should have been a lechatchila. That means an ab initio perfect situation. But nobody's in that situation. And nobody has had the courage from the beginning to reassess when you come up against a sign and Hashem shows you that you're in a mess. That's a very rare individual that has the courage to say, I was wrong in the beginning. I was wrong, admit it, go back and redo it. No, it stopped, didn't it? It's not so bad as yesterday, isn't it? And so you carry on. As a doctor, I can tell you, you should know the pain of being a doctor and meeting people. I sometimes have to deal with people who are sick. Terribly sick. I can't express to these people the fact that a simple difference in lifestyle, they wouldn't have been where they are now. There are certain lethal illnesses whose incidence is greatly reduced in people who marry young, for example. People who bear children young. It's not their fault. It's not their fault. That wasn't part of the value system. If you live a Jewish life, a basic common sense Torah values, apart from getting into the spiritual, even if apart from that, but you'll be protected. You'll be protected against all the things that a person can be protected against. But a person sallies out from a beginning that wasn't kosher in the first place. You can't expect protection. People come to me also, never mind as a doctor, people come as a rabbi. Why is this happening to me? What did I do to deserve this? So what did I do to deserve this? You shouldn't have been there in the first place, that's what. Why isn't Hashem looking after me? Because Hashem doesn't look after you when you get into a situation that's called Bori Hezekah. Shchiach Hezek. Bori Hezekah means a situation where there's danger. You don't get protected over there. Even if you're doing a mitzvah. The Gemara says if you're doing a mitzvah, you're protected. If you're on your way to do a mitzvah, you are guaranteed protection. Guaranteed. If you're on your way, single-mindedly, to do a mitzvah and only a mitzvah, you're guaranteed protection. But there's one exception. Despite that promise, if you're in a place that's known to be dangerous, there's no protection. Because that's miraculous. You don't deserve that. Not everybody deserves miracles. And if you do deserve miracles, by the way, and if it's done for you, they take it off your credit in the next world. Not good to need miracles. You use up a lot of merits. Very expensive. So even if you're on your way to do a mitzvah, you're not protected if you're in a place of danger. But you shouldn't have been in that place of danger. You're exposed to all kinds of dangers. This person has been exposed to lethal influences that they shouldn't have got into in the first place. The blame may be the parents. The blame may be the grandparents. But what kind of blame? The question is not blame. And the second lesson to take home from this is that every moment can be a new moment. No matter how lethal the situation. Even if it says, if the sword's on its way down and it's touching your neck already. Not resting, on its way down and touching the skin. There's still no time to give up hope. That's not the Jewish attitude. So make it a new moment now. No matter what kind of situation. If you do it powerfully enough, you take that circle and you shrink it to a point that has no dimension, then you can refashion it. And if you refashion it into a shape, that's not a circle. That means that every instant of the rest of the pathway is a chiddush. It is offer from the Eifer that it was before. So you can win any situation. You can recoup the damage. You can regain the loss. No matter how unideal the situation, no matter what a misery of a marriage situation or relationship, or parent-child relationship, if you're prepared to revamp the values and go back to the beginning, if you're prepared to completely undo it and start again, that means forgetting all the damage, forgetting all the blame, forgetting all the pain. Definitely. I didn't say it's easy. Go back right back to the beginning. Admit I was wrong here, I was wrong here, I was wrong here. Until you're back at the beginning. That can be done in minutes. And then you start the relationship again. It's not easy. Talking about making a brush. Talking about a pathway that's already been well trodden into the ground and the rut is deep. And you're talking about wiping that flat. That can be done. It can be much easier to do it the first time. It's much easier to have the values from the beginning and have a system that makes sense. And start out from the beginning before you get into the complications. And then you're treating the complications of the complications. How many times a doctor stand around intensive care? They're treating an infection. They're treating a complication of that. And the patient's very... They shouldn't have had the operation in the first place. It was a simple... See, people, complications of cosmetic surgery. We spoke last night here. We had plastic surgeons here. We spoke about plastic surgery, cosmetic surgery. You listen to the stories they tell you. The complications and the agony that people have. Because they had a... That a person should have the values in the first place that they should need that? That she should have had those values because the husband needed it? That people need already plastic surgery because the boyfriend doesn't like some feature or other? Wants dents where the bumps are, or bumps where the dents are? The boyfriend? That situation's strife. Never mind the values of the boyfriend. But the boyfriend's strife. The fact that there's a boyfriend's strife for you. Surgery on the body, is it a risk a person for that? We need a radical. We need radical surgery. That's okay. Not cosmetic. We need radical surgery. We need to go back to the beginning. You have to retrace your steps back to the conception. Sphere Sayyim is the time to do it. You need to retrace your steps. You need to go back to the time. You can do it now. You can go back to that time now. You need to restart that beginning. You need to make this beginning that beginning. That one, this one. That's what you need to do. The person does that in Sphere Sayyim. If they can go through the third, fourth week of Sphere right now, and halfway through the process, you have the courage to retrace their steps and go back to this midah and that midah, back to the beginning, and reform that. So, in Yitzhak Hashem, a person could get to Lag BaOmer next week, which is the time of fire, and re-experience, even in the middle of the process, a person could experience some of that original covenant of fire.